469, Americans for Prosperity Foundation against Anthony Albans. Mr. Dickerson?
Good afternoon, and may it please the court. Alan Dickerson of Baker and Hostetler on behalf of the plaintiff appellants. I'm joined today by my colleague, Erica Prouty.
Could you speak a little more loudly, please?
Of course, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And with the court's permission, I'd request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. Two federal circuits have already noticed that the Supreme Court, in recent cases, has strengthened the First Amendment's protections for donor privacy. This court should join the First and Tenth Circuits in requiring governments, when they request donor information, to show that their demand is narrowly tailored to an appropriate interest. And under that standard, Delaware has no prospect of success in this case.
We are on a preliminary injunction here, and your opening brief had next to nothing about anything other than the merits, and your reply brief didn't have much either. The district judge here said this has been the status quo for 11 years. You don't dispute that this is, you've been operating the same regime for 11 years, and you don't allege really much of anything apart from the merits here. So let's walk through non-merits factors. Is there any risk of this case becoming moot without a preliminary injunction? Is there anything in the record that would suggest that, or anything you've alleged?
Well, I don't think it would be moot, Your Honor, because the injury is the injury the Supreme Court identified in First Choice a few months ago.
Okay.
By putting us to the choice of unconstitutional donor disclosure or speaking.
So you've not suggested anything that would make this case go away. Now, how about the balance of equities here? You didn't bring this suit right away. You didn't bring this suit right after the Supreme Court's decision in 2021. Did you?
The answer is no, Your Honor.
Okay. We have case law that casts doubt on the equities. It suggests that's a factor against you because you've waited a while and suddenly you rushed in and begged that we have to decide this case before this fall election. And we've also said that the state has an interest in enforcing its laws. What makes that balance tip the other way?
Well, I think the balance tips the other way because of the presumption that this court recognized in Delaware Sports Owners or Sportsmen's Association. There is a presumption going to help back to Elrod versus Burns that the lack of First Amendment rights for any period of time is irreparable harm.
You can be.
Well, you have to show harm here. You have to show some harm. You made no record whatsoever. I don't think the presumption carries over in this type of case.
Respectfully, I disagree, Your Honor. I think what is required to show a First Amendment injury is a desire to speak, and the fact that the state will put you to an unconstitutional condition in order to speak. That's enough.
It can be irreparable injury. You do say some things about time sensitivity I'd like to ask your friends on the other side about, but don't the collection of circumstances negate the idea that there's something urgent about the harm here, that, you know, why you're suddenly coming in 5 years after Bata and saying, no, we are being irreparably injured. The court needs to stop this on a PI as opposed to waiting until final judgment.
Your Honor, if this were a case where we had been engaging in Delaware under the Delaware statute and had waited 5 years to come in and file the lawsuit, I would understand. That is not the scenario here. We filed suit as soon as we decided to engage with Delaware. We had not previously run any communication of this sort in Delaware. We had not engaged in Delaware. We hadn't availed ourselves of the Delaware statute in any way. And I'm not aware of any case that says—
When was the decision made to engage in Delaware?
Shortly before we filed the lawsuit.
Okay, when? What month?
I'm not entirely certain, Your Honor.
Had you been—
So you don't even know when the decision was made to engage with Delaware?
Not at that level of granularity.
And there's nothing in the record in the district court. The district court doesn't know when your client decided to engage in Delaware.
I'm not aware of something in the record, Your Honor. But again, I'm also not aware of a case that says you have to immediately come to court.
Okay. Well, you don't have to immediately come to court. You'd agree, wouldn't you, that if you're seeking an injunction, that time is of the essence?
Certainly, Your Honor. That's why we filed more than 6 months before the election.
Well, but your argument is based on the notion that Bonta has abrogated DSF, correct?
That's our merits argument, certainly.
All right, and if you're correct about that, that happened in 2021.
But we were not speaking in Delaware in 2021.
Is there anything in the record that suggests that you weren't considering coming into Delaware until very shortly before you filed this lawsuit?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor.
Okay. The district judge also said she was exercising her discretion not to grant an injunction. And we've said, even if you meet all the factors, you don't have a right to it. District judges have discretion not to grant regardless. Why isn't that an independent ground to affirm?
Because I don't believe that a court on the non-equities, or sorry, on the non-merits factors does have discretion to withhold an injunction in cases where the injury is inevitable and a decision not to.
Have you read Delaware State Sportsmen's Foundation?
I did, Your Honor.
Does it say that an injunction issues automatically as a matter of right?
Your Honor, it says there is a presumption for First Amendment cases.
You may presume it on irreparable injury, but it says even if all the factors are met, the court does not have to grant a preliminary injunction.
I am not aware, including in Delaware Sportsman's, Your Honor, of a court that said in a case where a state at the center of First Amendment liberties imposes an unconstitutional condition under which you may not speak during a period of the year, that a court has said that it is an appropriate exercise of discretion to deny an injunction on a theory that, well, they may speak at some point in the future.
What record have you made on the balance of equities?
The record we've made is that we will not speak during the period that Delaware has foreclosed because of this unconstitutional approach to donor disclosure. That's our injury. That's irreparable.
I didn't ask about irreparable injury. I asked about balance of equities. What record have you made or attempted to make or alleged that you would make on the distinct balance of equities?
Your Honor, there is significant case law that speaks to the fact that these things collapse in practical application where the government is the defendant.
Okay, factors three and four can be considered together when the government is defendant. Nothing collapses that into factor one or two.
So we're leaving aside factor one, I assume, for the moment.
Leave aside factor one, leave aside factor two.
On factors three and four, there is no governmental interest in enforcing an unconstitutional law.
Delaware State Sportsman says expressly you do not collapse that everything into factor one. The Ninth Circuit said so, and we rejected that for five independent reasons in Delaware State Sportsman's Foundation.
Your Honor, I think we win at step one, so I'll leave that aside. On step two, it's irreparable because of Elrond versus Burns and the fact that we cannot take a time machine back in time.
Okay, let's assume you're right on one, you're right on two.
On point
three.
Courts
are supposed to go to factors three and four, the merged factors. What do you say on those factors?
What I say on those factors is that there is no burden to Delaware in not enforcing an unconstitutional law. There's no governmental interest in violating the Constitution.
But there's a governmental interest in having information given to citizens about who is contributing to campaigns. It's a different issue from just it being unconstitutional. We have an informational interest that has been shown.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think that's just a restatement of the merits prong. The merits prong is whether or not the government's interest in fact is narrowly tailored to its regime. To then say it has an interest in enforcing its regime because of its interest is just a restatement of merits.
Is it your position that Bonta announced a narrow tailoring rule that hadn't existed before?
It's our position that it clarified that the law required narrow tailoring. The First, Ninth, and Tenth Circuits and this court did not apply narrow tailoring under their case law. So yes, for those circuits, it did change the law.
Well, Bond said that the district court was incorrect in not doing a narrow tailoring analysis, saying it didn't, because it didn't read our cases to mandate any such inquiry, that was error. So the Supreme Court is just saying our cases have always said narrow tailoring is required.
I think that was a widespread misunderstanding.
And were we prescient in 11 years ago in saying in Delaware Strong Families that the act is narrowly tailored and not impermissibly broad? We read that standard in there. So I don't know what your point is that Bonta did anything.
We may read DSF. Well, let me answer the direct question of Bonta and then talk about DSF. So in Bonta, the court clarified the standard, and it said all of the circuits who have read exacting scrutiny as only requiring a substantial relationship between the donor disclosure and the interest are wrong. There's an additional requirement of narrow tailoring. And as I said, the First and the Tenth Circuits have expressly said, we misread the old standard, we were incorrect, we're changing it. And if you read Judge Timkovich's opinion for the Tenth Circuit, he points out exactly why the Third Circuit is one of the circuits that misread the standard prior to AFPF versus Bonta. He's very explicit.
But when a colleague of mine on a panel of this court says, because the act is narrowly tailored and not impermissibly broad, we will reverse the district court. Now, if I were writing that, and then someone was reading it, I'd assume, and in fact, the analysis is about the breadth, whether it's overly broad and narrowly tailored. I don't know how Bonta makes any difference at all with respect to our law.
I agree with the first part of what Your Honor said. It does talk about it being overbroad. It does not apply narrow tailoring to the donor disclosure requirement. There's preparatory language looking at the act as a whole. I mean, part of the problem in this case is that Delaware is fighting the last war. Like, that was a case, much like McConnell, much like Citizens United, which were attacks on the concept of regulating electionary communications. They weren't specifically about the scope of the donor disclosure. So yes, this court, when looking at the overall act, mentions the phrase narrow tailoring in its introductory paragraph. Our position is that Judge Timkovich was right in reviewing the opinion and saying, yeah, but once you got to the actual, you know, analysis of the donor disclosure, you're very clear that you're applying, one, a substantial relationship test. There's no mention of narrow tailoring in that portion of the opinion, Your Honor. And then second of all, declining to consider less restrictive means, which is the hallmark of this test.
So let's say you're right, and that it used the form of words about tailoring, but it didn't apply tailoring with enough teeth. When this case goes to trial, what record would you make, would you like to make, would you put forward that you have an opportunity to make that would show that, you know, under the way that tailoring should be done post-Bonta, that this doesn't meet it? Are you going to make a record about earmarking? Are you going to make a record about, you know, effects of spending in one corner of the country on donors nationwide? Give us some sense about what going forward is going to show that even if this met the way we understood tailoring in 2015, it shouldn't meet the way we should understand tailoring in 2026.
So I'm not sure I reserve some time for rebuttal.
Sure.
A couple points, Your Honor. One, obviously the burden of showing tailoring would be on the state. But to our I think we would show, much as we showed in an affidavit here, that we have hundreds and hundreds, well over 1,000 donors, who have given small amounts of money to our nationwide organization in the periods that are regulated, that none of them were solicited for activity in Delaware, that none of them gave for the purpose of activity in Delaware, that none of them were on notice in any reasonable way that their funds would be used for activity in Delaware.
So what does that show?
That shows the lack of tailoring.
Do you expect to put forward any evidence that there are donors who've given who would have second thoughts or doubts about giving or giving again if they knew that it was going to be disclosed in Delaware, who maybe thought they were giving for other purposes or didn't know about the Delaware limit, et cetera, who some kind of evidence of chilling?
I don't think that'll be difficult to show because, one, there's chill as a matter of law after first choice. The Supreme Court said chill is inevitable.
Okay, first choice isn't a campaign case, but let's go on.
Understood, Your Honor. But second of all, I don't think that'd be hard to show on this record because we have an unrebutted affidavit that says, because of all the threats and harassment and reprisal, because of the fact that, you know, we have donors that want to give quietly, like, we have contractual obligations to donors not to publicly disclose them.
But might you put forward more at trial?
I think we would hope to, Your Honor, certainly.
And that evidence would be donor-focused rather than focused on the executives or the founders of the fund.
If I understand you correctly, yes, Your Honor. I mean, this is also our as-applied challenge, which we haven't talked about. But, you know, that this isn't a situation where there's one, you know, donor who's hiding behind a series of fake names. Like, this is a real organization with hundreds and hundreds of real people who donated to it that don't meet the state's actual informational interests, in fact, in the world we inhabit.
Right. I'm just not sure on this record there was evidence that the donors are at risk of protest or confrontation, or, you know, clearly there was evidence in the record that some of the higher-ups in the organization were.
I see my time's expiring.
Go ahead.
So I think there's this is complicated, and I concede this. We have two different as-applied claims. One is this claim, and this would be donor-focused, that if you give to an organization, and that organization has been the subject of threats, harassments, and reprisals, that you get an as-applied exemption from an otherwise constitutional law. Of course, we allege that this isn't an otherwise constitutional law, but that's one theory. And yes, that would be because you have given to this organization, because this organization has been subject to all of this, we do have chilled donors, in fact. The other is that we also have a bunch of donors that have no connection to Delaware under any reasonable understanding of Merritt Taylor, and like hundreds of them.
Is that in the record? Is there evidence in the record of that?
Yes, we have an affidavit from our regional director that says we have hundreds of donors who gave this amount of money, who have not been solicited, who did not give for these purposes, who are not made aware that we were going to do this. That's in the record.
Your friend on the other side is going to point out money is fungible. Supreme Court has precedents that talk about money being fungible. And so the fact that they have nothing to do with Delaware isn't enough, because they know they're giving to a nationwide organization. It's not like this is Americans for Prosperity Texas that suddenly branches out into Delaware. They're giving to a nationwide organization, and they can expect that their money is going to be spent nationwide.
I think our response, Your Honor, would just be that, no, they cannot expect years later that it be spent on a specific ad or a specific type of activity in Delaware. That's just too far afield. That's an argument for getting rid of Naylor Taylor. Mm-hmm. If money is fungible, there shouldn't be. The state asked for near plenary donor disclosure. And under their theory, I understand why. That's how they read the Supreme Court cases. I mean, I don't want to abuse my time, but I don't think they read the Supreme Court cases correctly. I don't think they can point to any language in the Supreme Court that uses this kind of money is fungible, therefore donors are plenarily disclosed kind of theory. And I think that's deadly to them on the merits point.
Mm-hmm. That might be a winning argument, but I think getting back to where we started, I'm troubled by the pace of this case, right? I mean, we don't have a fulsome record. We don't, you know, this is injunction cases are short-circuited in a lot of ways because of time being of the essence. And it seems puzzling that, and I'm not suggesting it was strategic on your part, your client's part, but we're a little bit of a disadvantage being sort of put on the verge of an election season, being told, hurry up, for something that could have been brought 5 years ago. And I'm just wondering if, as a practical matter, doesn't it make sense for the district judge to make a fulsome record and hear this case in the ordinary course? And the reason I suggest that is that even assuming you're correct that Bonta abrogated this court's decision in Delaware Strong Families, that doesn't seem obvious. And the reason it doesn't seem obvious is because that case is orthogonal, at least in the sense that it's a disclosure case. There's some language in it that's very helpful to you regarding freedom of association and disclosure. But it's unhelpful to you in the sense that it's not a campaign finance case. It's not. That's why I said I think we're orthogonal in at least one sense. So what about what I just said is mistaken?
Well, I think a few things, Judge. I mean, one is AFPF versus Bonta applies campaign finance cases. I mean, the standard it is using is the standard from Buckley versus Vallejo. So I think it is very curious to argue that the standard announced in AFPF somehow applies differently in political law cases. I don't think that makes sense given where the standard came from. So that's one thing. You know, another is just, and I don't want to repeat myself, but you know, that if we are correct that we are likely to succeed on the merits, and we are just talking about the balance of harms, then I really do not understand the theory that forcing an organization to remain silent for multiple months, an injury that everyone I have been under the impression has agreed to
irreparable. Is it forcing them to remain silent, or is it forcing them to disclose the donors?
Well, it's to put us to that choice.
Okay.
And that, if we are correct on the merits, so they are unlikely to, if that is not likely to be a constitutional requirement,
right,
then we're clearly irreparably harmed because we're going to have to violate our own constitutional liberties or remain silent. Classic irreparable injury. And on the other side, with all respect, I think the Delaware's theory of how they're harmed is awfully fuzzy. And you can see this in the fact that their whole theory is, we really need to know these donors. It's essential to the informational interest, unless you form this separate entity in a PAC and speak through that. And if that's their theory, I don't think they're harmed at all.
Well, we're going to press your friend on that, but I'm trying to get at the practical part of this, which is, as you know, this panel can't overturn a prior panel unless abrogation has occurred. And what I'm positing to you is that the abrogation, if it occurred, is not pellucid. It's a maybe. And if it's a maybe, doesn't discretion and prudence require that the district court make a fulsome record? It comes back to the Third Circuit. The Third Circuit then makes a decision. Either a panel does have the power because of abrogation, or maybe the panel looks at it and says, undermines, Bonta undermines Delaware Strong Families, but doesn't abrogate. And if it's just undermining it, then we're looking at an en banc situation for you to get relief.
I think two responses, Your Honor, because it's two separate questions. You know, the first question is, should this panel recognize that DSF has been superseded by the Supreme Court? And I think the answer is yes. And I think this panel can look to Wyoming gun owners, can look to the Gatsby Project case and other circuits. Those were not en banc decisions, where other panels of other circuits recognized that their case law was not in line with AFB versus Bonta and ruled accordingly. So I don't think this is, I think this is well-trod ground to Judge Rendell's questions. You know, and I think that is available to this court. So that, in terms of doing it in a preliminary injunction posture, I think, again, in a First Amendment case of this magnitude, where the injury to the government is essentially zero, because their theory is we don't have to disclose our donors anyway, then I think the balance of hardships very significantly tips in my client's favor, where they're going to have to violate the privacy of literally hundreds of people who have nothing to do with this decision to run things in Delaware. And that is unrebutted testimony in an affidavit that says that, as against the state's kind of amorphous.
Well, you're not going to harm the donors because you've made clear you're not going to run the ads if you have to disclose.
That's correct. We will censor ourselves.
And that just maintains the status quo for the last 5 years. You have not run any ads in Delaware for 5 years after Bonta, even though in your considered judgment, Bonta abrogated Delaware Strong Families.
I think it would be extraordinary, Your Honor, for this court to hold that remaining silent in anticipation of a future trial is not irreparable injury.
That would be
not
different.
Appropriate.
Maybe it's irreparable injury, but still it's the status quo. And there's plenty of case law that says preserving the status quo, I mean, the job is normally to preserve the status quo ante. So just because you check the box of life success and irreparable injury doesn't automatically get you a PI.
Your Honor, I agree that checking a box is not getting a PI.
Right.
I think filing an affidavit that spells out your harm, showing a likelihood of success on the merits, in a situation where the state's countervailing interest is either completely illegitimate or at a minimum extraordinarily slight. If that's the situation, if we were going to value status quo ante overall in First Amendment cases, that would be the outcome of that holding in this court. It would be a major precedent and a major shift in doctrine.
Is it your position that PAC donors are not disclosed? Because in footnote 10 of Delaware Strong Families, we said that disclosure requirements under PACs are more extreme.
I agree with you, I'm confused by their PAC theory. Let me back up. I think this PAC theory as an alternative is pretty obviously a result of litigation. It was never raised in Delaware Strong Families. It's new to us when we were doing the briefing in this case.
Well, but you rely heavily on that saying, well, Delaware really doesn't care very much because it says you can start a PAC, so it really doesn't care. But if under the PAC there's disclosure that's more extreme than otherwise, then that undermines your theory, doesn't it?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think it undermines their claim that they're badly harmed by not knowing our donors. If I can briefly address the PAC issue, and again, I'm yes. cognizant of the court's time, I think it fails for at least three reasons. One, it's just foreclosed by law. Citizens United That was the position of the dissenters in Citizens United, that a PAC is an alternative for a corporation to speak through. The court looked at that, it expressly rejected it. It said that is not an alternative to the corporation speaking directly. So I think that argument is just foreclosed as a matter of law. Practically, I also take issue, largely the same reason you mentioned, Judge Rendell. Like, a PAC is not, this is a square hole, you know, round peg problem. Like, a PAC is not designed to hide donors. A PAC is designed to do politics in a totally totally open way, where the donors who give to the PAC know they're going to be disclosed because they're giving for political purposes. So I think we're at total cross purposes. I also think they're wrong about the practical burdens of using it. Like, the state's position is all you have to do is go on the website and fill out this form. That's not true. If you look at the statute, you have to point to treasurer. That treasurer shares personal responsibility for the accuracy of the reports. Instead of just filing reports when you actually speak, which is what a third-party advertiser does, now you're a PAC. You have to file regular reports until you close. They have a line in their brief about how, oh, you can close up anytime you want as long as you lawfully distribute the proceeds. There's no citation for that. I don't know what lawful distribution is. Giving money to a PAC, I'm not sure you can claw it back. It simply is not, in practice, a substitute for speaking directly and filing an appropriate form.
Thank you, Mr. Dickerson. Let's hear from Ms. Burton.
Thank you, Your Honors. Unless Your Honors would prefer otherwise, I'll start where you left off with opposing counsel, which is that Delaware, as you might have heard, is the home of alternative entity formation. One of the things that Delaware's corporate structure or corporate code permits is the creation of alternative entities. Delaware's campaign finance law recognizes that you can form a PAC, but it also defines a person, which is who speaks under our campaign finance laws, as an unincorporated association, a limited partnership, or any one of a number of other creations. What this means is that as administered, and we put in evidence to this effect, if a large nationwide organization, such as Appellants, intends to speak with the benefit of all of its money, then the law requires it to disclose the sources of all of its money. But if it is the case, as appellants seem to suggest, that only a small portion of their donors, some identifiable group, intend to fund political speech in Delaware, if they intend to engage in ongoing activity, our campaign finance law lets them form a PAC. We don't have restrictions or limitations on the amount that can be contributed to a PAC, a Delaware PAC, which is what distinguishes us from federal law.
The PAC can support candidates directly, right?
It can.
But that's not what they do. They're doing issue advocacy.
They can also form an unincorporated association, which is what's most commonly done in this instance. That unincorporated association, it's explained in the Albence Declaration, would then receive donations from whoever it is that is going to fund this speech. The unincorporated association needs to disclose where it gets its money, but that's the extent of its disclosure. If a small
group that doesn't seem to support in any way how this law is narrowly tailored. It seems to be an admission that the law is not narrowly tailored. You're saying that they could go do other things. They're saying we don't want to do those other things. We shouldn't have to do those other things. And Delaware could very easily alter its law to look something like New Mexico's law. And if you gave them if you earmarked and you gave them opt-out opportunities, maybe problem solved, right?
Well, I think I'd like to start there. The Supreme Court, including in Bonta, has repeatedly held that campaign finance laws are subject to exacting scrutiny, which requires narrow tailoring, not least restrictive means. And interestingly enough, in Bonta, the Supreme Court said that that standard was longstanding based on pre-existing cases. So Delaware chose an option of tailoring that is not the same option that New Mexico chose, but that does not mean that it is not a tailoring option. With respect to whether the
statute... Tell us how your statute is narrow, because it doesn't seem to be. It seems to be very broad. You're casting a wide net. $100 isn't $5,000. And there's no opt-out opportunity. There's no earmarking. I mean, you literally, if this disclosure were to happen, you literally will be getting names of people who made a donation 3 or 4 years ago who live in who knows where, Alaska, Hawaii, California, who have never been to Delaware and don't care about Delaware. What's narrow about that?
Well, Delaware's law was based on the federal law. The disclosure parameters of the federal law were upheld in McConnell and in Citizens United, both of which are still good law. The Supreme Court has said that a circuit court can't consider one of its later opinions to overturn an earlier opinion unless that is expressed. So the fact that the federal system, as reviewed in McConnell and Citizens United, remains good law is not something that this court can disturb. The federal system requires donor disclosure. In Citizens United...
But you can't be arguing, are you, that narrow tailoring on the federal level is coextensive with narrow tailoring on the state level?
Delaware's statute differs from the federal statute in a number of ways. In DSF, those were the places where the court kind of focused in and looked at whether there was a state interest and a state-specific reason for those differences. With respect to the dollar threshold, the court looked at evidence, and we've submitted an affidavit and declarations in this case, for the proposition that Delaware's dollar threshold is based on the amount of money that it takes to reach roughly all of the voters in a given electoral district in Delaware. You can do it for about $500, slightly less if you're doing it by text today.
The record supported, according to our prior panel, both the narrow tailoring regarding the dollar limit and also the media. And that was based upon a record having to do with the specific facts of Delaware and its interests. Your opponent is focusing on the donors and the wide swath of donors that this encompasses. They're two different analyses. Which is correct?
I think that the court in each case looks at the arguments that the party presents to it. In DSF, the question of donor disclosure wasn't extensively litigated. It wasn't something that the parties drilled down on. Nonetheless, the constitutionality of DSF is a precedent, and it has been what everyone has been operating under for the last 11 years. Now, they would like to come in, and I think the record before you is incomplete with respect to how Delaware has been administering its campaign finance laws. One thing that is, very obvious to the Department of Elections and my clients, but maybe not to everybody else, is the fact that the DSF was decided before the case and the way that law was being implemented had really gelled. So the state didn't have a lot of real-world experience with what people were filing and how people were filing it. And today we do have a lot of evidence.
And that's not in the record because of the haste of this litigation, or?
We've put it into the record, Your Honor. We've put in the forms showing that you can form an unincorporated association, that you can disclose the donors who are specifically funding speech of that association, and that you can close it quickly if it is in fact a one-off political statement that's being made by a small number of people.
You're forcing them to form an alternative organization. That's the hill you're going to die on, that they have to form the kind of organization that Delaware requires? The 501c3 and the 501c4 that they have to be changed into a PAC or an unincorporated association?
They don't have to be changed into a PAC or an unincorporated association. If they want to speak with the benefit of all of their donors' money, the law simply requires them to disclose all of their donors.
But again, there's nothing narrowly tailored about that. I'm waiting for you to tell us how this law is narrowly tailored. And or point if point, if you will, to in the DSF opinion. I know the phrase narrowly tailored appears in the beginning of that opinion, but if you could point to us in the DSF opinion where the panel of this court that wrote that opinion evaluated why Delaware needs this particular combination of disclosure rules in view of the light of other available alternative ones, like the one in New Mexico, for example.
So where I would take you instead is Citizens United.
Okay, hold, before you, I'm happy to go there, but before you go there, does that mean there is nothing in DSF that satisfies my question?
DSF did not dig into the question of donor disclosure.
Or narrow tailoring.
It did address narrow tailoring.
Mentioned the phrase, but I didn't see any application of that phrase. What I saw an application of in DSF was substantial relationship. When you read the opinion, there is an explanation by this court as to why there was a substantial relationship. But I think we all agree that's not the test. Narrow tailoring is the test, right?
What I would say, Your Honor, is that the court did the narrow tailoring test when it looked at the factors of the law that it had, that the parties were litigating about in that case, and it assessed whether there was a particular state interest that required them to be broader or more burdensome than the federal standard. And that kind of granularity is narrow tailoring, even though it didn't specifically use the word narrow tailoring over and over again.
Well, we did say impermissibly broad.
You did
impermissibly
say
broad, which is the same, the flip side of narrow tailoring. But make at the record that Delaware put forth as to why this dollar limit was permissible, because $150 and $5,000 campaigns in Delaware may not have been the same in New York or Pennsylvania, and similarly the media, no television station, et cetera. So it seemed to look at the record and say, no, these, what it has put here is relevant and not overly inclusive in terms of its breadth, if you will. So, but and isn't that the same as narrow tailoring?
I would say that is the same as narrow tailoring, and to the extent that narrow tailoring, as articulated in Bonta, was something beyond just overly broad. That meant looking at individual facets of the law and looking at how the individual aspects of it go to the government's interest.
All right. Assume for a minute that you lose on likelihood of success on the merits. And assume for a minute that we think that because it's a First Amendment case that irreparable harm flows naturally from that. Tell us your best arguments, if you would, as to why we should not require the district court to enter an injunction.
Well, at that point, you would be reviewing the district court's denial of a preliminary injunction under the abuse of discretion standard. The district court would have looked at a record in which plaintiffs, as you've noted, have not spoken for 5 years. They could have issued an issue advertisement without falling within the third-party advertiser restrictions in Delaware up to the 15th of this month. So they could still actually issue one today without it being subject to regulation. So the harm to them is that they want to do something that they have never done before, and they want to do it during a particular 2-month window. And they have yet to really clearly identify what it is they want to say or how it ties to their mission beyond providing standing for this litigation. Conversely, Delaware has an interest in knowing who is behind political spending in Delaware. There are websites, blogs, newspapers, well, news websites, digging into our campaign finance filings daily and going through who is funding what and what Delawareans should believe based on who's funding those ads. Delaware, as corporate capital, runs into a number of situations in which people who are not Delawareans or fund ads about kitchen table issues because those politicians want, because those funders want specific changes to Delaware's corporate law and believe that the candidates they are backing will achieve those changes to Delaware's corporate law. And so citizens would reasonably want to know if the people funding these advertisements are corporate litigators out of California or, you know, Delawareans.
We don't have any donors before us bringing this action. Should that matter at all?
I don't think that you need a donor for standing. I think the lack of information about donors does address the harm issue. They haven't, I mean, for one thing, as the as-applied challenge has been articulated by the Supreme Court and by this court, an as-applied challenge is triggered when a donor would face harm or retaliation or harassment. And they haven't even attempted to argue that here. And I'll note, as we have all the way along, that the as-applied prong of this case is the only one that's not controlled by DSF. The other thing I will note is that while they talk a great deal about the reparable harm that they might face by not being able to issue the advertisements that they want during a particular two-month window without engaging in plenary disclosure, a lack of information when voting is also irreparable harm. And so there is irreparable harm on both sides of the scale here. The question is the irreparable harm of potential disclosure under a statute previously upheld, according to rules that everybody has expected to apply to this election, going to inflict more harm? Or is applying a special set of rules to plaintiffs with respect to this election, which wouldn't apply to other third-party advertisers on the eve of the election, going to work more harm to Delaware and the general public?
And that's an argument. I'd like to know if the district court were to hold some hearings on this, either now or at a trial on the merits. Well, I guess this is really an issue for the PI stage, but what harm would Delaware show or allege it suffers? Like, what benefits has it gotten from getting this information, say, on other organizations, getting their donor information? Help us to understand what you would either allege or prove about the magnitude of what Delaware suffers if it can't get this information.
So I think that in that case, we would bring in more affidavits from people involved in and running Delaware campaigns about how they look at outside spending, how voters care about it, how it affects voting. I think that we would potentially depose Delawareans about their views on how SB 21 funding, which is what's currently affecting Delaware's political landscape, and the sources of that funding going into Delaware's upcoming elections might affect their voting. I think we would pull information from our website, our campaign finance system, showing how many people access it, how many people look at it. I think we would gather more information and present it to the court on the ease of forming an alternative entity through which to speak and the extent to which that is functionally not much of a burden at all.
You did not seek to make a record on this below, correct?
We did, Your Honor.
You did?
We did. We put in affidavits from the commissioner about how easy it is to form alternate entities. We put in evidence showing that Delawareans are gathering, looking at, reviewing, and considering this information.
Okay. Did Americans for Prosperity attempt to make a record on unbalanced equities on this, or the magnitude of the harm on their side? There were some references to some threats on their end, but anything else about you know, difficulties here or lack of benefits or any of those other things you were talking about?
Americans for Prosperity in the first instance did not identify anything that they intended to politically speak about. They have submitted evidence alleging that their donor base is a certain size and includes a number of donors who are not from Delaware or interested in Delaware. Delaware submitted AFP's website as evidence. That website notes that they are engaged in advocacy in 50 states and indicates that they have a chapter in Delaware. To the extent of injury, AFP did not submit any admissible evidence concerning any threat or harm to their organization. They did submit a declaration which contained hearsay describing alleged threats to upper management, and they cited to some opinions which mentioned, with one exception, in dicta, that there had been threats.
Okay.
And that record was undeveloped because it's an injunction hearing and the district court didn't write, the district court ruled from the bench, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the district court really didn't evaluate because the facile answer, at least as the district court saw it in the expedited manner in which the case came before the district court, was the Third Circuit has spoken. DSF controls, end of discussion, right?
The fact that a plaintiff needs to show some probability or possibility, depending on the case, of success on the merits was a major factor in the district court's decision. Mm-hmm. DSF notably was considering a preliminary injunction as well and reversed the district court's grant of a preliminary injunction.
But if this court they indicate that DSF should be read with some scrutiny in view of Bonta, then that might result in a different factual presentation besides between both parties before the district court on remand, would it not?
I would be remiss to not mention Rule 9.1 of this court, which requires a conflict between intervening precedent and precedent of a panel in order for a panel of this court to reverse. So I think the state's position is that you could not effectively say Bonta's or DSF is not binding. Setting that aside, I think that in the absence of binding precedent with respect to the merits, the district court certainly could have directed the parties to develop the factual record about a balance of the hardships in more detail. The challenge to that direction, Your Honor, is one of timing. We would be remanded to the district court. If appellants would like to speak after November 4th, their speech will not be governed by the statute, which only applies from August 15th through November 4th of this year.
And if they want to speak in the next 5 days?
They can do so without any disclosure, because as long as it is an issue ad, it will not constitute an electioneering communication until it is within 30 days of Delaware's primary election.
And there's no evidence that they've run ads in the time period where they would not have to make disclosures?
There's no evidence that they have run ads in that time period. They have not disclosed any funding or advertising. In their reply brief below, they indicated that they were still determining who they intended to support.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Burton. Let's hear rebuttal from Mr. Dickerson.
Your Honors. A few things. I mean, one, if Delaware is going to wrap itself in the federal rule, The federal rule is that donors are disclosed to give for the purpose of electioneering communications. And we deal with their Supreme Court precedent at pages 18 to 21 of the reply brief. I'd be happy to talk about that if it would be helpful. But if that's the rule they want, I don't think there's a conflict between the parties. Like, it is also the rule we would like. So I don't think that gets them there. In terms of the harm to the state, they talk a great deal about the record and about the fact that they need to inform their donors, or sorry, inform their voters of the identities of the donors, leaving aside the fact that I think that is completely nullified by the theory of a separate entity being able to hide those donors. It also doesn't really line up with the record. They submitted the entire record from Delaware Strong Families. In that record, which addressed the purpose behind the act, it's very clear that what they're trying to get at is anonymous ads. Kind of going back to Citizens United, like ads that try to take themselves entirely out of the regulatory structure. If you look at those ads in the records, they don't even have paid for by disclaimers on the front of them. So, you know, the state is already having a significant vindication of its interest in our concession that we'll register with the state, that we'll provide the list of our expenditures, that we will put on the face of those communications who is paying for them. This is not the pre-act situation. And that goes, I think, pretty strongly to the state's legitimate interest in knowing who's speaking shortly before the election. And I guess one more point on the record, I'm not aware of a requirement that all evidence at a PI standard stage be admissible. I think hearsay is permitted in the PI stage. So there are attempts to bypass the fact that we have an unrebutted affidavit that says, no, this will chill donors to our organization. We have made guarantees that we can't go back on, that people not want to contribute to us, that this will have real concrete harms for our organization if we move forward. I think that has to be credited at this stage procedurally.
But the district court didn't even have to make an evaluation on that, right? In its view, because it was just defaulting to DSF, right? Isn't that what happened here?
You read my mind, Your Honor. I think that's exactly right, and that was going to be my
next point.
All right,
so if we think that perhaps a default to DSF was not the prudent course and DSF should be scrutinized based on subsequent developments, namely Bonta and anything else that might have happened in the Supreme Court in the past 10 years. Again, why not remand for a fulsome hearing so the district court can get its marching orders to do it over again in a much more detailed way, without haste? It's a tricky case. Both sides have good arguments. Prudence seems to dictate in every way, shape, or form that this case be put on the normal track rather than on the fast track. Why am I wrong about that?
I think prudence indeed does require that for the merits. I take no issue with the fact that once the election and communication period has expired, that there should be a more fulsome approach to the merits here. No objection. The problem is that asking us to remain silent for this period is classic irreparable First Amendment injury. And if it is this court's position, and I think this court has everything it needs to rule on the probability of success on the merits.
That really has been the thrust of your briefing.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That presumptive irreparable injury has not been the thrust of your briefing. And you cite cases to us that aren't election campaign disclosure cases.
Your Honor, Elrod versus Burns is the case every political lawyer cites in every First Amendment case for precisely this position.
But it has not been the thrust of your briefing. The thrust of your briefing has been less intrusive alternatives, narrow tailoring.
I agree, Your Honor, because again, the case law is pretty clear that if you show a likelihood of success in the merits of First Amendment deprivation, you win an injunction. And that's, I understand that we can talk about all of this, but the district court didn't even address the non-merits arguments. And it's not because we didn't raise them. You know, we made very clear, again, we had an affidavit on what our injuries were. The state has no countervailing interest in enforcing an unconstitutional law. Its theory that we should speak through an alternative organization and hide our donors is a torpedo below the waterline of their theory of their informational interest. And if you add all of that together, I think this court has enough to enter or to remand with instructions to enter a preliminary injunction. And I understand that we'll be back here at some point talking about the reality of the merits here. But
would you at least concede that there's a layering here that complicates matters? If we were writing on a blank slate, if DSF didn't exist, it would be a lot easier for this panel to evaluate everything in the record and make a decision about whether there's a First Amendment violation or not. But we're not writing on a blank slate. We have rules to follow. We do not overturn past precedent unless we go in bank or unless an intervening Supreme Court precedent abrogated it. And wouldn't you admit that there's that layer, the complicating factor, because it is not pellucid. Maybe you just disagree with me when I say it's not pellucid that Bonta abrogated DSF. Is that the crux of your argument? I'm just wrong about that.
I think so, Your Honor. I think it's very hard to read the opinion.
And that we have a different view of what abrogation means, perhaps, because to me, abrogation is, for example, when the Supreme Court in Kennedy v. Bremerton says, we overrule Lemon. Okay, then we know whatever past precedent we had that applied Lemon is not good law anymore, right? That's a clear statement. I see orthogonal influence by Bonta that might support your argument, but it sure doesn't look like the kind of clear statement that I just gave you by analogy, does it?
Well, I think it is, because the Ninth Circuit in Bonta applied the exact same standard this court applied in the third in DSF and was overruled. So I think it is more on point maybe than Your Honor does. But if I could just address this question of the remand, if you're right, Your Honor, and if it is an intervening variable that's not just a smokescreen that we need to all just sort of power through, I don't think it's necessarily fair, with all respect to the district court, to say we have questions about how all these things fit together and remand for the district court to make an initial decision on how DSF works with all of this. I think it is the responsibility.
Well, we do that all the time. We quite prefer to make decisions after reading district court opinions based on a full district court record, ample research, and thoughtful writing by our district court colleagues. That's actually how we prefer to do our job, not an overburdened trial judge that has to hear something on an expedited basis and then makes a judgment call from the bench without writing an opinion.
But not in First Amendment cases, Your Honor.
Well, that may be true, but it's also true that the status quo has existed for 5 years. This case, there's nothing that could have prevented this case from being brought in February. Or last July or last August, right?
Again, Your Honor, I'm not aware of any case that says you have to decide to speak sufficiently in advance of a preliminary injunction posture.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Dickerson. Thank you, Ms. Burton. The court will take the matter under advisement.